Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So if this is an odd date, the markets must be up, right? Because that's the way it's been going. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, managing more than $2 trillion in assets and providing investment solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com. And by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 11th of August. Good to have you with us. What I'm about to say might sound counterintuitive, but pay no attention to the Dow. Not the NASDAQ, not the S&P, not the Wilshire 5000 or the Russell 2000. You want to know what's going on in the markets? Dial yourself over to the Chicago Board Options Exchange and check out something called the VIX, the Market Volatility Index. It measures almost literally how freaked out we really are, how investors feel about the future volatility of the markets. It measures what kinds of precautions they take to protect their portfolios and their investments. Robert Whaley is a professor of finance at Vanderbilt University. He is also the father of the Fear Index. Welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you.
So the VIX is a phrase being thrown around fairly freely these days, as I'm sure you've seen. I wonder if you could tell us what it's really supposed to measure, though.
It's supposed to measure what volatility investors expect over the next 30 days. And volatility is a measure of the swings, if you like to see swings, as we have in the past couple of weeks or so.
Seems like kind of an interesting experiment, quantifying what, if you look at a chart of the Dow, for instance, you know, we all feel in our gut.
It is. It's a measure of the price of portfolio insurance. I mean, we all have equity portfolio investments in one way or another, and at times like this, you're concerned about losing a lot of their value. You have two options. One is you can get out of stocks and buy treasuries. The other thing you can do is buy insurance. You buy insurance through buying S&P 500 puts. The more puts that are purchased, the higher the price goes.
Explain that in layman's terms for me, would you?
I mean, suppose you owned a house on the North Carolina beach.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have insurance on it, and you know insurance is $500. Then you become aware there's a hurricane off the coast, and you have a great likelihood of getting hit. Chances are you're going to pay more than $500 for insurance. And that clamoring for insurance, given the increased odds of some disaster happening, is going to go way up. And so what you're seeing is investors being anxious about the value of their stocks they have in the portfolio for their pension and retirement. So they're willing to pay more and more for insurance. The VIX is simply the price you're paying for that in insurance.
All right, well, let me ask you this then. Is it not possible that knowing what's coming creates more volatility, that a rising VIX creates a rising VIX?
Can you frame that question a little differently?
Sure. Is it possible that this thing, knowing how nervous people are, makes people more nervous?
That would be a behavioral type of interpretation. What makes me more nervous, actually, is sort of the movements that we're seeing in the stock market on a daily basis. This VIX is just telling you that they expect those types of movements to persist. But yes, I mean, you're seeing that the price of insurance is going up, and so it makes you wonder, if you're seeing the price rise, whether people smarter than you that know there's going to be an event, so you might jump in too.
Well, so, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned the event coming, perhaps, because I'm looking at a chart now of the VIX, and
uh-huh.
It goes back 7 years, I guess. Right in the middle is a huge spike when Lehman Brothers went under in 2008. And if you look at the VIX today, it's trending upward along those lines.
Well, I mean, you have to put things in perspective, too. VIX has spiked many times over its history since 1986. The highest level it got to was 170-plus in October 1987. So the level you see at it now, I think it's hovering around 41, is not that large.
Do you watch CNBC at all?
I do.
So what do you think of when they spend minutes on end talking about the VIX doing this and the VIX doing that? I mean, is it serving its purpose, do you think, when it's used that way?
It is serving its purpose. I view it as a measure of how anxious people are feeling about the stock market. And if you look over the past few months, they weren't all that anxious. And just by glancing at that number and looking at it relative to its historical levels, I know something's going on.
You know what it reminds me of a little bit? It reminds me of the stories you hear from the old days when they didn't have weather satellites, just to get back to your hurricane example, and you didn't know what was coming.
Exactly. That's a good analogy.
Well, feel free to use it.
I will.
Robert Whaley, professor of finance at the Owen Graduate School of Management at Vanderbilt University, the inventor of the VIX. Professor Whaley, thanks so much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
My name is Jane Dougal. I turned 65 years old this week. I live in Rhinebeck, New York, and I'm an academic reference librarian.
Like a lot of us, Jane's been following the craziness of the markets of late, trying to understand what it's going to mean for her. She is 65, as she just said, hoping to retire one day.
At one point in my life, retirement had this lovely glow to it that it was you could sit on a beach and you know, have a glass of wine and relax, and your days would be long and leisurely. And now it's, I wonder if I can retire by the time I'm 70 or 75. And I wonder if I can keep getting in my car in the morning in the winter and going to work. When I retire, my total income will be $1,200 a month. The good news is $1,200 a month. The bad news is if something happens and the markets keep falling, the retirement plan that I have at my institution will deteriorate further and that number will go down. I feel that my retirement funds are in jeopardy and there is no way that I can control it. I hear on the media that younger people or people can ride it out, but at 65, there's no room to ride it out. Given that, I need to work as long as I physically can, although it becomes difficult. You become more tired. And at the same time, I worry about my keeping this job as long as I can. I worry about the fact that there are young people graduating in my profession who need jobs, and those of us who can't afford to retire at this point in time are keeping the jobs that they need to come into.
Jane Dougal wrote to us through our Public Insight Network. You can share your story at publicinsightnetwork.org. There was lots of sharing today on Wall Street. You could just feel the love there. You can trade the VIX, by the way. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Yet another lesson from the past couple of days is that market turbulence pays no mind to national pride. France is one of Europe's most proud nations, but it has been taking a licking this week. There were the bank rumors yesterday about Société Générale and reports that France might, like us, be stripped of their AAA credit rating. From the European desk in London Marketplaces, Stephen Beard has the story.
France is one of the twin pillars of the 17-member Eurozone. Alongside Germany, it's the mainstay of the single currency and therefore carries much of the burden of bailing out the weaker members. That's the problem, says economist Simon Tilford.
Because Spain and Italy are now in trouble and might need bailout, investors are getting increasingly concerned about the impact that will have on the creditworthiness of other core Eurozone economies.
And France in particular, because French banks have been the most extravagant lenders in Europe and may also need bailing out by their government. Daniel Gross of the Centre for European Policy Studies.
The French banks are much more exposed to both Spain and Italy, which are the two candidates which are most at risk right now.
All this fueled yesterday's rumour that one of France's biggest banks, Société Générale, was in trouble and that France itself was about to lose its AAA credit rating. Both rumours were emphatically denied. But there's been an ominous development today. An unnamed Asian bank reportedly stopped lending to French banks. Daniel Gross.
If the French banks come under attack, if they're cut off from refinancing from other banks, then the French economy will go down and French public finances will deteriorate.
And France could indeed lose its top credit rating, undermining its ability to contribute to the bailout fund. The Eurozone is drifting closer to the reefs, says Bob McGee of research firm Independent Strategy.
So we remain in this area of uncertainty and doubt, which could lead, actually, to a significant crisis over the next few months, unless we see action, particularly from the Germans.
Today, French President Nicolas Sarkozy said he will meet the German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Paris next Tuesday. Could be promising, says Simon Tilford.
The fact that contagion has now spread to France will hopefully focus minds.
But Merkel was reluctant to prop up the euro when she had the pillar of France to depend on. Will she do it now that that mainstay is buckling? In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
I mentioned the Société Générale rumour on the way into Stephen's piece. He talked about it, and you might think that's overkill. But fact is, rumours have been flying this week about everything from the Federal Reserve's next step to the strength of the Swiss franc. And as Société Générale shows, those rumours have teeth. Shares of the bank dove more than 15% yesterday, got some of it back today. And this morning, Reuters published and tweeted a story about how, again, as Stephen mentioned, but that's how rumors get started, isn't it? People mentioning things all over the place. Stephen talked about how one Asian bank had stopped lending to the French, rumor had it, citing only anonymous sources. That story hit the markets, hit them hard, and it does make one wonder if maybe information is moving too fast. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has that story.
Joshua Brown is vice president of investments at Fusion Analytics and a big presence on Twitter.
At Reformed Broker.
He says Twitter is the main way he gets his information.
I have canceled my subscriptions to all the regular news sources because I'm kind of crowdsourcing instead, and I could see what's affecting the market by what other traders that I follow and other journalists that I follow think is important.
Brown says rumors do fly, but a critical mass of tweeters can quash false statements quickly, but not quickly enough for Paul Kodrosky. He runs a hedge fund and has more than 160,000 Twitter followers. He says a Twitter rumor can get enough traction to move the markets before the truth comes out.
Where if something gets repeated often enough, even if it's not true, then you do have people change behavior.
Kodrosky says that's especially the case in a volatile market because people are desperate to stay ahead of the herd. And he says you don't always know where you're getting your advice.
This weird false intimacy that's created by Twitter where people feel like you know them because I see them tweeting all day long and it's like, oh, I know you had hamburgers and you're short the Swiss franc. Great, I trust you.
And knowing who to trust is the real difficulty in the age of Twitter and texting and emails and blogs, says Rice trader Jeremy Zwinger.
Yes, things are faster, but yes, also find the truth. It's almost overwhelming and you have to be able to filter.
Because the wall tweet rumor mill is likely to keep getting bigger. In New York, I'm at S. Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
There's not much arguing that our elected officials have helped put us in a fairly bad financial bind with all the budget and deficit stuff that's going on, but on second thought, why take it all so seriously? Politics can be a funny business, which helps explain why Stephen Colbert's Super PAC just launched its first ad of the 2012 campaign. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
When the Federal Election Commission gave Stephen Colbert the go-ahead to create a political action committee, he didn't say what he was planning.
There will be others who say, Stephen Colbert, what will you do with that unrestricted Super PAC money? To which I say, I don't know.
Now we know. The Colbert Super PAC, called Americans for a Better Tomorrow Tomorrow, has released its first ad ahead of the Ames straw poll in Iowa.
Write in Rick Perry. That's Perry with an A for America. With an A for Iowa.
Texas Governor Rick Perry spells his name with an E for exists, maybe. Anyways, the Iowa GOP, which runs the Ames straw poll, didn't seem especially amused. The spokesman told me that write-in votes would be counted according to Iowa election code, including voter intent. But what's the intent of a vote for Rick Perry with an A?
Some voters might be intending to vote for Rick Perry and not know how to spell Perry and might spell it with an A. Some voters might be intending to cast a Colbert protest vote.
Rick Hassan is a law professor at UC Irvine.
Well, I think that it's completely ambiguous, and that is why if this were a real election, I would find Colbert's behavior very troubling.
Hassan says it's an example of the mischief a Colbert super PAC could cause in the election in ways intended and unintended.
It really is a little bit Colbert playing with fire.
Maybe funny fire, but still fire. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up, in China, there's a new language.
We are now in front of a store called Red Grass by Horn Monopoly. It's closed, and I'm wondering what they sell.
Yeah, me too. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, it was all about the buyers today. The Dow Industrial soared 3.9%, 423 points, closed at 11,143. The NASDAQ regained 4.2%. 111 points, ended at 2492. The S&P 500 rose 4.2%, 51 points, ended the bull run at 1172. Market set a record for schizophrenia in the process, four straight days of 400-point swings up and down. Gold bugs got bitten lightly. The glitter was down $22 an ounce to $1,761. VIX dropped 9.2%. Remember, I said you could trade that. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.32%. The 30-year got clobbered. Remember, it was the long-term debt that got downgraded. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the knowledge effect. And by Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at progressive.com. Entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing resource to 4 million small businesses, with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/marketing. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Retail therapy or just window shopping? We'll see what happened in July when the Commerce Department releases its monthly retail sales report. Health professionals discuss end-of-life care at a summit on the science of compassion, concluding in Bethesda, Maryland. And the United Nations marks International Youth Day with the theme, Change Our World. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media, APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Down deep in the substantive stuff that drives the markets, aside from bank rumors and rising VIX feeding on rising VIX, there was this item from yesterday. The big computer networking company Cisco looks to be doing pretty well, despite or perhaps because of big layoffs. Cisco reported generally solid earnings. They beat expectations, always important. The outlook was generally positive, also important, as long as you don't dig too deeply. Down to the part where Cisco noted that one of its biggest customers is cutting way back on spending. A customer by the name of Uncle Sam. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Traditionally, it's been government spending that's helped struggling economies come back from recessions and worse.
Anxiously, we waited for some sign of better days. Then came the federal government's work program.
Normally, when you're in a recovery, that's when all governments ramp up expenditures. They hire more people, they spend more money, and they add to growth.
Economist Joel Naroff says this time, though, is different. The government isn't just short of what he calls fiscal capacity. It's under intense pressure to slash spending.
That's why the whole discussion that will be going on over the next few months to find out where those spending cuts will come from is so critical to businesses.
Cisco CEO John Chambers as much as conceded that during his conference call with analysts yesterday.
We anticipate global public sector spending to continue being a challenge for the next several quarters.
If governments aren't going to be buying as much, the Brookings Institution's Jennifer Bradley says they need to be careful to get the most bang for the bucks they do spend.
What you find is that government is having to do workarounds.
Bradley suggests government can stimulate the economy and spur job growth by investing in technological innovation, and spending isn't the only way to encourage that.
The government can, for example, set standards or create kinds of regulations that spur the development of new technologies. Companies will know that there's a guaranteed market for these new products and services that they're trying to develop.
Bradley says the word stimulus may have fallen out of favor, but the government's critical role remains. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
My name is Karen Port. I live in St. Louis. We sell high-end hot tubs. You know, when I saw the S&P decision that they were going to downgrade our rating, and I'm thinking, holy cow, this is the first time that they've ever done that. What's going to occur to our business? And even though I'm a tiny little itty-bitty business, it ripples down to us where our customers start to worry and not come in and like they did in 2008. And we're just now at that point that they're feeling comfortable. In terms of this year, we are slightly ahead of last year. Our busiest season is August through November. And then this hits. And I'm thinking, oh, just when we are barely standing up, we get knocked out. We have a wide range of customers. We have middle class to upper class. What I'm concerned about is that that middle group is going to go away, and they're not going to be able to spend. I'm hoping that we are not going to see that our line of credit ends up getting pulled. We would have to pull money out of our savings. Our staff right now is 5. That includes myself and my husband. We were at 10. If it comes to it, I won't take a paycheck.
Karen Port is the owner of Mirage Spa in St. Louis, Missouri. Back before the Beijing Olympics, there was a park in that city honoring China's ethnic minorities. The Chinese Ethnic Culture Park is the proper English translation. Unfortunately, sign makers over there don't have quite as good a command of English as they think they do. So on local signage, it was racist park in English instead. Chinglish is the term that expats use for that. It's the kind of thing that turns signs on a wet floor, for example, from beware of falling in Chinese into fall down carefully in Chinglish. The government's doing its best to get rid of Chinglish in the big cities, but as tourism rises in the rest of the country, Chinglish, it is realized, is far from a dead language. Marketplace of China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
The waterfalls and turquoise lakes of Zhuozhaigou attract millions of tourists every year. That's why I came here, too. But I got distracted by the town's business district. It was chock full of signs in Chinglish. I spent the evening going door to door, reading dozens of them.
We are now in front of a store called Red Grass by Horn Monopoly. Red Grass by Horn Monopoly. It's closed, and I'm wondering what they sell.
Chinglish comes in many varieties, sometimes poetic. The name of one restaurant here is Incense Filled the Street by the Fish. Sometimes you can sort of guess what they're after, but they didn't quite get it, like the shop called Veteran Barbecue. But then there's the Chinglish that makes no sense at all. It's as if a dictionary threw up a random sampling of its contents onto a sign. That's the category that Red Grass by Horn Monopoly falls into. A smiling man named Wong owns the shop next door, a place simply called Yak Meat.
As for my neighbor's sign, we have no idea if the English is correct. I'll have to tell them their sign is confusing. They sell yak-related items like yak horn combs and things like that.
Yak horn combs? Maybe they're better off with a Chinglish sign.
A lot of these signs are not actually meant to be understood and to be read by foreigners.
That's Oliver Lutz-Radke. Mr. Radke is at the University of Heidelberg, finishing his PhD in, I kid you not, Chinglish. That assures him life of the party status at every academic conference he attends. Radke says as more Chinese travel around their own country for the first time, they enjoy seeing signs in English, no matter how badly mangled that English may be.
They are breathing a supposed kind of internationalism, supposed kind of cosmopolitanism, which works because the English language competence with national tourists is still pretty low.
Yeah, but don't these businesses care about getting it right for their English-speaking customers? As Radke tells me, getting it right is oftentimes an afterthought in China, unlike the West.
We're big, big masters of planning everything and thinking everything through before we actually lift a finger. In China, I think it's the complete opposite. You first go.
And shopkeeper Wang says that's what happened in Zhoujiago.
The government requires us to display the name of our store in Chinese, Tibetan, and English. I'm pretty sure the Tibetan and English are incorrect.
Ah, so the English signs are required by the local government. Across the street is a shop called Tibetan Technology Supermarket. I asked the shopkeeper, Jai Dejun, who he paid to translate his sign. He says he didn't have a choice. The only translation service allowed to do business in Zhoujiago is the local government. And that's something everybody understands. In Zhoujiago, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We've got a whole selection of questionable Chinglish translations on our website. It's marketplace.org. Check it out.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, actually more of a preview for tomorrow's broadcast, really. We're going to go out on the road to see how real people are holding up, what with the economic yo-yoing the past week and a half. I caught up with Monica and Christine Launer this morning, mother and daughter, vineyard proprietors in Santa Barbara, California.
Well, I'm very pessimistic. I think this problem is going to last for many, many years. But we have noticed that the wine business hasn't suffered very much.
Well, I'm a little bit more optimistic because, that was my mom and I'm her daughter. My whole family works in the wine business. We're very, obviously very, very careful to watch what the trends are, what consumers are doing. Maybe this is a cycle that'll go through quickly. That's what we're hopeful of. But we're in it for the long haul.
More where that came from tomorrow on a live roadshow. But for now, that's Marketplace on this Thursday from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow put back on 423 points, 3.9%. The Nasdaq jumped 111 points, 4.2%. The S&P 500 bumped up 51 points, also 4.2%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back on The Big Show, something a little bit different.
10, 15, 15, 20. It's hard to see you there. 20, you win. 20, 25,
25, 30. Sold. The Auction House as economic indicator. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.